Good. Well, ladies and gentlemen, warm welcome to to the first in what will be the European Institute's Fixing Europe series of dialogues. There is a Twitter hashtag, should you be so disposed, for this event, which I'm told is #LSEFixingEurope. The event will be recorded, and if all goes well technically, you will also be able to access it, should you wish to catch up with it afterwards, or spread the word by podcast online. Now, the conventional wisdom, of course, is that the European Union is actually rather good in a crisis. At 2 minutes to midnight, when all seems lost, the political leaders stop the clock. They keep talking, and eventually they find a way to pull the fat out of the fire. Something is found for everyone, and then it's back to business as usual, and the EU's train can trundle out of the station towards ever closer union as set down in the Treaty of Rome. Now, every few years, the last 50-odd years, of course, heads of state and government take a pit stop, I guess you could call it, with an intergovernmental conference or a huge consultative convention or what they call a reflection group, or they might even ask a group of wise men, they all seem to be men, to stand back, to take a deep breath and to do some thinking. Whatever the format used for these intensive thought sessions. Their job is to review the European Union's institutions and its competences and its decision-making. There's just one problem with this approach, though, it seems to me, and that is that these gatherings never deal with policies. But how could they? Policies, for the most part, are for nation states, and we're still in a Europe of nation states, trying to work together within a fearsomely complex multi-level system of governance and mixed competences. So the idea of fixing Europe is a pretty daunting proposition. For Michael Oakeshott, the great conservative philosopher who flourished here at LSE for many years, the idea of fixing a society or fixing its institutions was what Ludwig Wittgenstein would have called a category mistake. The skills needed in politics are not the skills needed to bake a cake or to repair a car. You won't find them in a recipe book or a DIY guide or some how-to manual or even a bluffer's guide. And if you'll forgive a short lyrical excursion, just quoting Michael Oakeshott again, he said, "In political activity, men sail a boundless and bottomless sea. There is neither harbour for shelter, nor floor for anchorage, neither starting place nor appointed destination. The enterprise is to keep afloat on an even keel." So I think Michael Oakeshott would probably have disapproved of the title of this series, Fixing Europe. But Oakeshott was also a realist, and I'm sure he would have agreed that the alienation of Europe's citizens from Europe's main collective project since the Second World War, is now of a scale and nature which we have never encountered before. The stark evidence of this is likely to be laid before us in just a couple of weeks' time at ballot boxes, as ballot boxes are opened across the continent. And I guess Europhiles and Eurosceptics can at least agree that this is bad news. So what do we do about it? Well, for all my admiration of Oakeshott, something tells me that just to keep the ship afloat, we're going to need to do some pretty radical thinking. Well, we were in no doubt. What we needed to do, our job in the European Institute of the LSE, was to invite some of the EU's cleverest minds and most original thinkers to come and share their ideas with us, which is why we asked Roger Bootle, my left and further left, though that has no political significance at all, Philip Le Grain, to come and kick off our Fixing Europe series by telling us about their new books, just published and on sale outside this theatre. Now, Roger Bootle is one of Britain's best-known and most widely respected economists out there in the public space. As one of the recent reviewers of his book put it, he has a spectacularly good record on the big economic calls of the last few years, including the US's real estate bubble and then the credit crunch, the collapse of the dot-com boom, and the pound sterling's expulsion from the exchange rate mechanism. He runs Capital Economics, which he founded in 1999. He's also a specialist advisor to the House of Commons Treasury Committee. He has been Group Chief Economist at HSBC and has served on umpteen high-level advisory panels, committees. He's been, been advisor at the Treasury, you name it. Philippe de Grain established his reputation as a brilliant young thinker at some ridiculously precocious age, as I recall. Most recently, he's been an independent economic advisor to the President of the European Commission and has headed the team that provides President Barroso with strategic policy advice. He did that from February 2011 until 2-3 months ago, in fact. He's been a visiting fellow in the European Institute, which I had here at the LSE, an independent commentator, consultant, and so on. And he's also been special advisor to the Director General of the World Trade Organization, where at which time, I seem to recall, he published a very well-received book on the benefits of globalization and putting the classical liberal case in a global context as effectively as I can recall. Now, I'm going to ask Roger Bootle to begin, and I'll spare his blushes by telling you that his book is called The Trouble with Europe, Why the EU Isn't Working and How It Can Be Reformed, What Could Take Its Place. After Roger Bootle has shared some of his thoughts with us, I will ask Philippe to do the same, and then in best traditional LSE fashion, I hope we're going to have a lively, spirited discussion, debate, until 10 o'clock, what is it? Well, if only. I fear we haven't got quite that amount of time. Until 8 o'clock, and I know you won't be shy of coming forward with questions. So without further ado, I will hand over to Roger. I'll just mention actually at this stage, though, as well, that for those of you inclined, having heard these great thinkers and their utterances, to actually go and to buy their book, you've probably seen on your way in that it is available outside, and Roger and Philippe will be happy to sign copies of their book, of their books, here on the podium between 8 and 8:15. So without further ado, Roger, I'll hand over to you, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much. I must say, I think it's the first time I've ever been described as on the left, albeit not quite as far on the left as Philippe de Grain. I'd like to start by thanking you all for coming along, thanking the European Institute for organising this and the LSE for making this wonderful hall available, and indeed also to Philippe for agreeing to debate with me this really fascinating and ultra-important subject. Let me just briefly say something about what I'm going to talk about this evening. I'm going to start by saying a few words about the origins of the EU, then to try to answer the question whether or not it's been a success. I subsequently want to address the question, anyway, of my book, that's to say, what is the trouble with Europe? Then what needs to be done to put it right? Lastly, how would things be, what would things be like if the UK withdrew, before briefly making a few concluding remarks. So let me start off by saying something about the origins of the EU. I do think it's terribly important when thinking about the future and the question of whether the EU is fitted to today's world to actually spend quite a while thinking about the origins. What were the people who put it together thinking of and fearing? What sort of institution was it? What were the dangers and hopes of the time? And what were the conditions of the time? I don't wish to teach grandmothers to suck eggs. I've never quite understood what the point of that expression is, but anyway, to tell you, go over what you already know. But it's worth emphasising that, of course, the EU was conceived very much in the shadow of the Second World War. When the Treaty of Rome was signed in 1957, it was only 12 years, indeed, since the end of the Second World War. This had an enormous impact on the way that the European leaders thought about the project that they were embarking upon. One of the major motives, indeed, was to prevent there being another European war. In the shadow of the Second World War, but also very much in the foreshadow of what might come to be an even more terrible conflict. Because at this point, of course, the Cold War was raging. This is also terribly important. It was a world of, throughout the late 50s and early 60s, a world of two large superpowers vying with each other. On the one hand, the United States, and on the other, the Soviet Union. And the traditional nation-states of Europe were caught in between economically, politically, militarily, in every single sense. At the time, it seemed that this is what the future of the world was going to be, a competition between these two blocks. Now, of course, it was possible for the nation-states of Europe to line up with the West, as it were, under American leadership, and that's exactly what they did. But that, of course, meant that they were in vassal status to the United States. This was a rather new and uncomfortable position to be in, and it was a natural thing to imagine the emergence of a third unit, a third bloc, that's to say a European one. Very much part of the early thinking. At that stage, also, not only were there those things that were there, it's also worth noting the things that were not there. And in particular, at this point, there was, so far as I can tell, no sense that the Soviet Union or the Eastern Bloc were about to collapse and that therefore Europe was about to be reunited. And this is terribly important with regard to the question of the boundaries of the EU. The EU that was conceived then, of course, it wasn't called the EU, it was called the EEC initially, but the boundaries of it were very much in the West, the Western part of Europe, without a clear idea as to what the limits to Europe might be. Moreover, of course, this was a time before the advent of globalization. Well, I say that in the post-war sense because, of course, as you all know, the world had been intensely globalized, in fact, in the 19th century, but had then gone through a period of the collapse of globalization. And at this stage, when the EU, as I call it, was formed, this was before the modern movement of globalization. Of course, before the internet. At a time when China was pretty insignificant, actually, on the world scale, about as significant economically as the Isle of Wight, and the term emerging markets had not even been imagined. So that was the world into which what we now call the EU was born. And, of course, it and the world have changed a good deal since. Has this creature conceived in that way been a success? Well, not being a raging Eurosceptic of the sort of mad, staring eyes, stripy, blazered variety, I think the answer is partly yes. And that may surprise some of you. Partly it has been a success. For a start, of course, there's been no European war. Now, I happen to think there's a lot in the remarks and views of those people who argue this isn't largely to do with the European Union, it's more about NATO and the fear of the nuclear bomb, but it seems to me that's not the whole of it. The fact of the matter is that there was a coming together of European countries, and principally France and Germany, because of the, what we now call the European Union, and that has done the peoples of Europe an enormous amount of good. And I don't want to poo-poo this objective. After all, besides that's to say keeping the peace, the odd percent here or there on GDP, quite frankly, pales into insignificance. So insofar as the EU contributed something to that in the early years, it's worth, I think, a fair amount. The second sense in which I think the EU has been actually a resounding success is in something that wasn't envisaged at the time, something that's purely accidental and something that I think is largely past in its relevance. That's to say, acting as a receiving house for what I call the refugee countries from Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc. Not envisaged at the time that the institution was constructed, for obvious reasons, as I highlighted a moment ago. Certainly the EU wasn't set up to fulfil this function. It happened, as it were, almost accidentally. But I think the EU did perform a very useful role in this regard. The ambition of joining the EU acted as a spur and an incentive to these countries to behave in a sensible way, both economically and politically, and once they were in, it kept them on the straight and narrow. This also, I think, has been a significant achievement. What about economic performance? Well, it's a mixed bag, this. If you look at the early years, superficially at least, economic growth in what we now call the EU, or the members then, was pretty impressive. From 1957 to 73, which was the year when the UK joined, the average growth rate across what we now call the EU, the membership then, was just short of 5%. In the UK of the equivalent period, it was 2.8%. You can readily see, when contemplating those numbers, why just about the whole British political and economic establishment thought it was a pretty good thing to join the EU. This was a vibrant, apparently extremely successful economic unit. And by contrast, Britain was floundering, even though 2.8% was an extremely good growth rate for a country like Britain to have achieved. In fact, one of the fastest, perhaps the fastest, for a sustained period in the whole of our history. But actually, just looking at the growth rate doesn't do much justice to the complexity of the arguments, because I think it's pretty clear that much, if not all, of this superlative growth performance in the early years was down to the starting point. That's to say, the devastation of war, the fact that in so many of these countries, agriculture occupied a pretty prominent role, you could substitute labour, move it from agriculture into industry, and enjoy some pretty good rates of growth of productivity. Nevertheless, there was also some favourable boosting from the freeing up of trade within what we now call the European Union. However, as you move later on, the relative performance of the countries in the EU has fallen quite considerably. And I think this is the way of looking at it, not relative to its own past. The growth figures in the individual countries of the European Union are a lot lower than they were in that previous golden period, but rather looking at the performance of those countries relative to other countries around the rest of the world, including the UK, the US, Canada, Australia, and so on. And when you do that, you see that the relative position of the members of the EU has fallen quite considerably in terms of relative growth. Relatively speaking, the EU has been a growth failure over the last 30 years or so, of course accompanied more recently by pretty high rates of unemployment. So I would say that on the answer to this question, has the EU been a success? It's a mixed answer. Politically, I think it's achieved a good deal in its early years. Its early years were also marked by considerable economic success, but recently economic failure. And in particular, it's very notable that one doesn't see huge numbers of delegations from the emerging world or East Asia rushing over to Europe to find out quite how to do things in their own countries. Insofar as they come, it's to find out how not to do things. Right, so what is the problem, or as I put it, the trouble? What is the trouble with Europe? Well, there are a number of different aspects, I think, as to what's gone wrong or what no longer suits the world that we live in, and I'll briefly try to lay out what they are. The first derives straight away, and appropriate this, from the beginning, that's to say from the Treaty of Rome, and it is the objective of ever closer union. That's the objective to which the signatories of the treaty signed up in 1957. This is a very important thing, it seems to me, far more important than was realised by the blockheads in Britain, who debated the price of fish and various other things and didn't seem to understand that this was really very much a political project right from the beginning. It's important because when you joined the EU, and indeed when you accepted the various subsequent EU treaties, you weren't so much accepting a set of conditions or agreements now as actually agreeing to a process, the destination of which was unclear. It was just a continual moving carpet, if you like, towards the next objective along the road to ever closer union. I think that's a big problem, not least because so many of Europe's people don't want it, and in this country it's what
the majority of the people didn't think they ever accepted. Now, you might say it's their fault. They were misled, I think. They never thought they were being dragged into a political union of this sort. What's more, I would argue, it has some serious economic and political consequences, even if people did want it, and I suppose some people in Europe do want it. For a start, there's the whole issue of how you go about forging ever closer union, leading ultimately towards a political and fiscal union, one presumes, among countries that are really so disparate in culture, political culture and other sorts of culture, disparate in economic structure, in habits, in attitudes and preferences. How do you do it? Well, I think the logic is you have to do it by cajoling them. The direct result of the forcing people towards the objective of ever closer union, the direct result is excessive regulation and interference, which in the end has some significant economic costs. Then there's the whole question of democracy. There's no doubt that as things stand, there is a substantial democratic deficit in the EU. Now, I suppose it's possible to imagine a refashioning of the institutions such that that deficit is eroded. The powers of national parliaments fade as they fade. The powers of the European Parliament rise. Constituencies are redrawn at the European level. We have the formation of trans-country parties. And we listen to the same broadcast. We think across the countries of Europe, we directly elect the President of the European Union. We make all the institutions of the European Union fully accountable. It's possible to imagine how the European Union could become fully democratic. I use the word imagine advisedly because we can just about imagine it. Is it actually very likely or very practical? Well, I think the answer is no. For a start, the sheer size of this entity before it embarks upon further expansion is enormous, way bigger than the United States in terms of number of voters, the second biggest political entity trying to be democratic in the world after India. With this diverse history and diverse institutions, I think it's highly unlikely that its democracy would be at all satisfactory. In this regard, the language and cultural barriers are, I think, extremely important. The late Enoch Powell, not that I agree with an awful lot of what he said, but he did once say it's impossible for there to be a European democracy because there's no European demos. And I think essentially he's right. In order to have a fully functioning European democracy, you've got to have a common political culture and a common language across Europe. There's another sense in which I think this forcing together has had costs. That's to say, there's a lot to be said for the benefits of having competition between nation states in Europe, not competition leading to warfare, but economic competition leading to improvements in the way governments behave, in the same way that we know that this brings benefits in the corporate world. There's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that it brings benefits in the world of government. And indeed, it's quite striking that I think in Europe's golden age a few hundred years ago, this was, of course, a Europe of nation states who were very much competing with each other. Then there's the question of what the limits are to the European Union. What is it, this union? What's it there for? What's its essential raison d'etre? It started off, of course, as a union of six countries, which together just about amounted to the Holy Roman Empire. And then, by a gradual process of extension, it's come to include most of what historically was regarded as Europe, although it's got a very different setup from what made up the Roman Empire, which was a very much a Mediterranean concept, taking in, of course, North Africa and much of the Middle East. And that's an issue which today's Europeans find difficult to grapple with. What is it? Is it an attempt to recreate a modern version of Christendom? Is it just an association of geographically close states? What is it? Is it objective, should it be to get bigger and bigger as more countries qualify? Should we try to bring more and more European countries into this association? In this regard, the litmus test, as in so many other questions, is, I think, Turkey. Can and should Turkey be a member? I've got a clear answer to this question, actually, which I state in the book. I think Turkey is such an important country geopolitically that I want Turkey to be a full member of whatever the political association is that occupies, if you like, common political space in Europe. Having said that, if she were to join the EU as currently constituted, well, for a start, I think that's a complete no-no, and potentially it's a disaster. Having essentially a Muslim state and a state with the history that Turkey has in an EU that's pushing towards full political and other union is a no-no. It's no way it's going to get past European electorates. And this, I think, is a great shame, because I say I think Turkey is so important. So I would put the question the other way around. That's to say, what is the sort of association that we could have in Europe which would allow us willingly to embrace Turkey as a full member? That's the sort of political association I would want to have in Europe. And of course, it can't be one that has free movement of labour, it can't be one that presses on towards ever closer union, and it can't be one that wants political union between all its member states. It's some loose association of member states that have friendship and trade relationships and so on and so forth. That's the sort of political union that I would want to see. I'm still talking about all the various things that I think amount to the trouble with Europe. Linked to its comparatively poor relative economic performance over recent decades is the problem of fading influence in the world. The share of European GDP in world GDP is falling quite sharply. And unless something happens to improve its economic performance over the next few decades, that's going to continue with the result that European influence in the world is going to fade. Now, in case you get me wrong, I'm not an anti-European. On the contrary, and although I'm British, I'm very much a pro-European. I love Europe, European culture, everything European. I want Europe to succeed in the world. For me, the question is rather, what sort of political and economic arrangements across Europe are more likely to make Europe succeed in the world? And the answer to that question for me is, well, at least, not the current lot, thank you very much. All the signs are that they're going to lead to comparative European failure. Okay, well, what needs to be done to set the European Union right, which is, after all, the theme of the talk and the series, Fixing Europe? Well, I would say, right at the very beginning, an end to the objective of ever closer union. Or if some countries want to maintain that objective, then at least the ability of some of them, including the UK, to opt out. And following on from that, cast iron guarantees regarding the position of countries like the UK and maybe other ones who wish to occupy that second tier with a lesser degree of integration. When I say cast iron, I think they'd have to be in the form of a treaty, because other agreements would simply not be believed. They wouldn't command confidence. For the sake of the European Union as a whole, even if Britain were outside that inner core, I think the Union needs some concept of the limits to its geographical expansion. Otherwise, it will be impossible to plan for the future, either economically or politically, impossible to fashion its institutions properly, and impossible to function properly on the world stage. I believe it needs a reduced EU budget. Of course, if you are going to build an integrated state, federal state, from these diverse nation states, it's rather the opposite. You need an increased EU budget. But of course, that's precisely not my objective, and I see massive signs of waste and inefficiency leading to considerable alienation of people across Europe. So I want to see the budget significantly reduced. I would also want to see significant repatriation of powers from the centre to nation states. Now, for the sake of Europe as a whole, I would like to be that to happen on a Europe-wide level, but speaking just about the UK, if it couldn't be had for the Europe as a whole, then I would want to see it guaranteed for the UK, and that would include social and employment legislation. Now, other people, of course, will cut this particular cake differently. My own view is that Britain will be better off out of the single market. So my requirements are actually quite tough. That's to say, as well as all these things, I would want Britain to stand outside the single market while still actually being a member of the EU. And of course, under current arrangements, that's not possible. So again, there would have to be a definite treaty change to make that possible. And indeed, I would want to go further and have the British Parliament have the power to reject EU directives and other sorts of legal impositions or rulings from the EU. Well, there's my own little shopping list, which is quite extensive. Let me now briefly say something about how I think things would be if the UK withdrew from the EU, which would not be my first best objective. I mean, my first best objective is to stay in, renegotiate within the EU, and get the best deal possible for Britain. But I have to say I'm quite sceptical about the extent to which any British government would be able to wring a suitable deal out of our fellows on the continent. I think it's going to be unlikely. Well, on this question, I think a lot of nonsense is spoken, actually. There are arguments on both sides, and a lot of studies that have looked into this come out with estimates of the relative costs or benefits. Some on the fringes are very extreme. A lot of them are actually almost within the margin of error. The truth of the matter is that a lot depends upon things that are inherently very uncertain, including what sort of trading relationship we would manage to negotiate with the EU. I don't think myself, in terms of the static benefits, the figures are actually that big. But one thing I'm quite clear about in my mind is that there wouldn't be a catastrophe. It would be perfectly possible for Britain to function, I think, pretty well outside the EU. I hear a lot of people talking about, oh gosh, how can Britain possibly contemplate leaving Europe? Well, of course, it wouldn't be leaving Europe. That's a geographical impossibility. All it would be leaving is a particular political construct that, for the time being anyway, happens to hold sway on the continent of Europe, along with umpteen others in the past, which held sway for a time and didn't last very long. We couldn't and wouldn't leave Europe. Others say we'd be turning our back on our largest single market. Well, we wouldn't be turning our back on it. We would continue to trade very extensively with it. The question is, on what terms would we trade? Would we be within the single market? Would we opt out of the single market? Would we be able to have a free trade agreement with the EU? These are the questions that need to be asked. We wouldn't be turning our back on that market. Indeed, I think it's pretty clear that most of British trade with the EU would continue. In regard to what sort of arrangements we would have, a lot of people, of course, discuss the Norwegian and the Swiss arrangements, and it's worth looking into those. I personally don't think either of those offers a suitable model for Britain. Norway, as you know, is in the European Economic Area, which does give it full access to the single market, but it also means that Norway has to accept an awful lot of EU legislation without having much influence on what that legislation actually is. Both Norway and Switzerland make some contributions to the EU funds, or not quite at the full budget contribution level that would follow if they were fully members. In the Swiss case, its relationship is secured by a series of bilateral agreements, which are awfully complicated, don't give Switzerland actually full access to the single market in regard to services. And in any case, if Britain wanted the Swiss deal, I think it's highly unlikely that it would be on offer. There's considerable dissatisfaction in the EU with the arrangements that the Swiss have got. The deal that I would regard as most favourable, would be a free trade agreement with the EU. And the reason I'm in favour of that rather than the single market is that it's from the single market that so many of the regulations flow that people in Britain resent and think are economically ineffective. Now, in regard to that, I'd just like to point out to you that around the world there are a lot of countries, including the United States, China, India, Singapore, South Korea, umpteen others, that are trying to get closer trade relations with the EU. Unsurprisingly, because the EU is such an enormous economic area. To the best of my knowledge, none of them is seeking to join the EU or to mimic being a member of the EU. None of them wants to be a member of the single market. What they all want is a free trade agreement with the EU, which is precisely what I think Britain should be aiming for. None of the regulations. Admittedly, we wouldn't be able to trade exactly on the same basis as countries within the single market. Those firms selling into the single market would have to comply with those EU regulations, but those firms not selling into the single market would not have to. And that's pretty important. Although our trade with the EU is, of course, extremely large, depending on how you measure it, roughly speaking, around about 50%, less actually on some measures, and could be as low as 40%, but roughly 50% of our exports go to the EU, and we roughly speaking export about 30% of our GDP. And that means that roughly 15% of our GDP is directly associated with exports to the EU. It's big. But unless my arithmetic has finally defeated me, I think that means that 85% of the economy is not directly associated with the EU. And that, I think, is an extremely important point, because that 85% still has to comply with this great wave of regulations emanating from the EU. How would we stand with regard to other trade setups if we had this relationship with the EU? I think the big benefit would be we would be able to negotiate our own arrangements with a series of countries around the world. We would be able to join NAFTA, for instance. We would be able to negotiate our own free trade agreements with China, India, Singapore, and so on. And we would be free to develop closer ties with the Commonwealth. I don't want to bang on ad nauseam. I don't even bang on ad nauseam in my book, which I hope you will all buy. I'm not bothered about when you read it, but you should at least buy it. But let me just say this. In my view, the basis on which the EU was founded is an idea whose time has passed. We must either radically reform the EU, allow it to break up, or in the case of Britain, leave it. Thank you very much.
Roger, thank you for a spirited and challenging presentation, which I'm sure will have raised the hackles of quite a few people in the room. I'm sure that was part of the intention. Plenty, I'm sure, to get our teeth into. So when we get into, when we have when we move to open discussion. But that was a great launch pad for our discussion. Thank you so much, Roger. And I'm now going to ask Philip to come to the lectern and to present his book, which I will again spare his blushes now by showing you the book. It's called European Spring: Why Our Economies and Politics Are in a Mess and How to Put Them Right. So, as you can see, both our speakers are have set their sights pretty high, courting hubris, some might say. But that's the whole point of this is to really to think the unthinkable and to be daring. And you've certainly done that, Roger, and I suspect that Philip is about to be just as daring. Sounds stimulating.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Maurice, for that kind introduction. Thank you to LSE for hosting this event. And above all, thank you to all of you for taking the time to be here. Now, my book is on covers a different topic than Roger's, and I'm sure we'll have a vigorous debate afterwards, but I'm going to present the ideas in my book, and then we can clash swords later. Europe, and yes, that includes Britain, is in a mess. Our economies are failing to deliver higher living standards for most people. In Britain, real wages have fallen by nearly a tenth, and a typical household is no better off than a decade ago. The average German earned fractionally less than 15 years ago, as does the average Greek. 26 million Europeans are out of work, and they include 15 million young people who are neither in employment nor education. A lost generation is in the making. And we've had the worst recession since the 1930s, and now we have the flimsiest recovery on record. Extremely weak in the Eurozone, a return to housing bubble and bust in Britain. Most of Europe has zombie banks and crushing debts. Most of Europe has feeble productivity growth and low investment. All of Europe is aging fast, and without immigration, workforces are set to shrink. So if you combine depressed demand, inadequate investment, poor productivity, and demographic drag, Europe seems set for stagnation and decline without radical reforms. And depressingly, most Europeans think that younger generations will have a worse life than they do. Now, the present economic pain and fear of the future are poisoning politics too. Many people no longer trust mainstream politicians, EU technocrats, and elites in general. They seem self-serving, captured by vested interests, incapable of solving Europe's problems, let alone setting out a compelling vision of a brighter future. Some are even losing faith in democracy itself. Social tensions within countries are multiplying, as are political frictions between them. Understandable anger at the injustice of bailouts for rich bankers and budget cuts for poor school children overlaps with the despicable scapegoating of outsiders, notably immigrants. Scots will vote on whether to split from Britain in September, Catalans from Spain in November. Bombs go off when Angela Merkel visits Athens. The project that binds Europeans together, the European Union, has never been more unpopular. Britain may even vote to leave. And the EU's crowning achievement, the euro, is increasingly seen as a sadomasochistic straitjacket. As a result, most Europeans now associate the EU with austerity, recession, and German domination, with constraints on what they can do, rather than how we can achieve more together. And this anti-EU, anti-foreigner, anti-establishment mood is fertile ground for extremists and charlatans who look set to do extremely well in the upcoming European elections. The far left may come top in Greece. An anti-establishment movement headed by a clown is running second in Italy. And xenophobic and reactionary parties like UKIP or France's Front National or Geert Wilders' PVV in the Netherlands are on a roll. Ultimately, our open societies, post-war Europe's most amazing achievement, are at risk. So as well as radical economic reforms, our politics needs to change too. Now, in order to start to put things right, we need to be unflinchingly honest about what's gone wrong. It's been nearly 7 years since the first bank in the Eurozone went bust and was bailed out by the German government, and likewise since the run on Northern Rock here in Britain. Yet Europe's banking crisis is still unresolved. Governments have tried to prop up nearly every distressed bank with taxpayers' money without forcing them to face up to their losses. And the result is state-sponsored zombie banks that keep zombie companies alive while denying credit to promising businesses and draining public finances. And by placing the interests of banks and their creditors ahead of ordinary citizens, and by failing to fix the economy's problems, policymakers have shredded trust in their motives and in their competence. And the flip side of not forcing banks to recognise losses is that debt write-downs have been rare, and households and companies have struggled to bring down the huge debts they accumulated in the bubble years. And the capture of policymakers by the banking sector is also the primary cause of the crisis in the Eurozone. When Greece's public debts became unsustainable in 2010, it ought to have been handed over to the IMF and its debts written down. But to avoid losses for French and German banks that owned lots of Greek banks, policymakers pretended that an insolvent Greece was merely going through temporary funding difficulties. And out of the pretense that the financial stability of the Eurozone as a whole was at risk, they decided to breach the legal basis on which the euro was founded, the no bailout rule, and to bail out Greece's creditors. And suddenly, the bad lending of private banks became obligations between governments. And in Ireland, Portugal, and Spain too, Eurozone policymakers insisted that local taxpayers pay for foreign banks' mistakes. And this strong-arming also benefited British banks, which had lent to bust Irish and Spanish banks. So a crisis that could have united Europe in a collective effort to curb the banks that got us into this mess instead divided Europe, pitting creditor countries against debtor countries, and with EU institutions becoming instruments for creditors to impose their will on debtors. In effect, the desire of the Greeks, the Irish, and so on, to be part of Europe, and their fear of being forced out of the euro, have been abused to impose unfair, iniquitous conditions on them. And that is the very opposite of the solidarity on which the European project is meant to be based. And both British and Eurozone policymakers also wrongly concluded, as a result of the Greek fiasco, that Europe as a whole faced an immediate fiscal crisis. And while failing to tackle the banking problems and the private sector debt problems, they lurched into collective, excessive austerity, depressing demand so much that they actually worsened public finances. And as a result, both Britain and the Eurozone have suffered an unnecessarily long and deep slump. A longer and deeper recession than the United States, which has been growing since 2010 and has since grown by 7%. A longer recession than Europe during the 1930s. And in the case of Greece, a longer and deepened recession than Germany during the Great Depression. And then Eurozone policymakers compounded that mistake by sparking panic. And they responded to panic by demanding ever greater austerity. Now, for what it's worth, a study by a European Commission official using the Commission's own economic model concludes that this collective excessive austerity resulted in a cumulative loss of GDP across the Eurozone of nearly 10%. And nobody has been held to account. Then finally, in the summer of 2012, the ECB intervened to halt the panic. Austerity was eased off, and economies have stabilised. But just think how much misery could have been avoided if the ECB had intervened sooner and policymakers had not squeezed so tightly in the first place. And the enduring legacy of bailing out the banks that lent to Greece is a rigid system of centralised fiscal controls. Because Angela Merkel agreed to breach the no bailout rule, on which her predecessor, Helmut Kohl, had so rightly insisted in the Maastricht Treaty, German taxpayers suddenly feared that they were liable for everybody else's debts. So she demanded much greater control over other countries' budgets, and the European Commission was only too delighted to oblige. Now, this is economically dangerous, because if you share a currency, you need much greater fiscal flexibility, not less. And it's politically poisonous, because when voters in a country turf out a government, the first thing that happens is that Olli Rehn, the EU's economics commissioner, pops up on television and says, you must stick to the same policies of the government that you've just rejected. Now imagine, if a remote, unelected, and scarcely accountable official in Brussels tells you that your legitimate choices about tax and spend are not compatible with EU rules, how would you feel about the EU? And if voting for mainstream politicians doesn't lead to a change of policies, then naturally people are pushed towards the extremes. And now, after an unnecessarily long and deep recession, the recovery is the flimsiest on record. Here in Britain, we have investment at near record lows. exports flat despite the wonders of a devalued pound, and record high borrowing from foreigners. In effect, Britain's spurt of growth is based on a house of cards. Far from a march of the makers, it's a flight of the speculators. And in the Eurozone, the recovery is too weak to bring unemployment down to normal levels anytime soon, and too weak to enable economies to grow out of their debts. So yes, financial markets are all ebullient, but public debt is still rising, private debt is even bigger, and with inflation sharply down and prices even falling in some places, nominal GDP is stagnant. So the risk is very real that Southern Europe is going to be forced into a deflationary debt trap. And precisely because the fear of imminent doom has abated, politics is likely to become more turbulent too. So to finally solve the crisis, the Eurozone ought to do what I advised President Barroso back in 2010, and which also would have been applicable to Britain. Restructure zombie banks to restore credit to businesses. Write down debts, both public and private. And support spending in ways that pushes the economy towards healthier patterns of growth, notably by stimulating investment and lifting barriers to competition and enterprise, with Germany and other surplus countries playing their part in boosting domestic demand. And the Eurozone's institutions also need fixing, because instead of a Eurozone shaped by Germany's narrow interests as a creditor, we need a Eurozone that works for all its citizens. We need a properly independent mechanism for restructuring failed banks. We need an ECB that acts to avert future panics. We need to restore that crucial no bailout rule, and with it much greater freedom for elected governments to tax and spend as they please, constrained, of course, by markets' willingness to lend, and ultimately by the possibility of default. And eventually, we should create a Eurozone Treasury that is properly accountable to both European and national parliamentarians, with limited tax raising and borrowing powers. Ultimately, a reformed Eurozone like that is in Germany's interest too, because surely it would prefer to be surrounded by a contented community of equals rather than a wasteland of vassal states. Now, Europe's economic crisis is more than just a banking and debt crisis. It's also a productivity crisis. Europe is falling ever further behind America. Over the past decade, productivity growth in both Britain and the Eurozone averaged 0.9% a year, half that in America. And if productivity scarcely rises, neither can wages. Europe just isn't dynamic enough, and it finds it difficult to cope with and adjust to change. Just look, the digital revolution that is shaping the way that we live and work is largely happening elsewhere. The new giants of our digital world, Apple, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, PayPal, eBay, WhatsApp, they're all American. There's no European equivalent of Silicon Valley. And while the gap is glaring in the internet economy, the problem is much broader than that. Just look, whenever there is a new technology or social change, we Europeans focus on the risks and the costs, not on the perceived benefits. One in two Europeans thinks that you shouldn't even start a business if there's a risk it might fail, as there inevitably is. Europe's big companies are all old and entrenched. In the United States, 20 of the 100 most valuable companies are less than 40 years old. Guess what the figure is in Europe? Zero. And Europe also faces much greater competition from China and other emerging economies in increasingly higher tech sectors. So you see that Apple's biggest rival in smartphones is not Nokia, which is now owned by Microsoft, but Samsung. The global leader in solar panels is no longer Germany, it's China. And Britain's biggest manufacturer is India's Tata. Now, of course, this rapid growth in China and elsewhere is a huge opportunity for Europeans. I wrote a book about it. But it also requires big adjustments. And then, of course, there's demography. Because as the baby boomers retire over the next 15 years, the burden on younger generations is going to be huge. As the labour force shrinks, as it will, without further immigration, economies will need to notch up faster productivity growth and increased investment merely to stand still. But if the economy is likely to stand still, why invest? Now, the barriers to dynamism and change are many. But the biggest underlying problem is that Europe's economies are often strangled by vested interests that stifle opportunity and steal the value created by others. A bloated, state-subsidized financial sector that extracts value from companies and households and does a poor job of allocating capital to profitable investments. Big landowners in rigged property markets who benefit from vast subsidies from the common agricultural policy in rural areas and capture the value created by others' investment and hard work in urban areas. Incumbent companies, both big and small, insulated from competition. Labour market insiders privileged at the expense of outsiders, young people, immigrants, locked out of the labour market. Public sector bodies, which are often run for the benefit of the people who work there, rather than to the patients, the students, and others who benefit from their services. Politicians and technocratic elites, who often pursue their own interests rather than the common good. Each of these, in effect, steals from others, both by grabbing an outsized share of the existing pie and by limiting how fast the pie grows. And eventually, without reform, vested interests clog up the economy so much that growth comes to a halt. So to create lasting shared prosperity, we need to break the grip that vested interests have over our economy and make our economies more adaptable, more dynamic, and more decent through reforms that add up. Open up the labour market to young people and outsiders. Break the stranglehold that companies, both big and small, have over cartelised markets. Complete the single market in services and energy and open up more to trade and investment. Welcome young migrants who can help care and pay for the old and as well as stimulate new ideas and businesses. Capitalise on Europe's biggest resource, the creative diversity of its people, and unleash their entrepreneurial spirits. Create a smaller, simpler, and safer financial system by eliminating the tax advantages of debt and property speculation, by forcing banks to fund themselves with much more equity, and by folding banks that fail, or by bailing in their creditors rather than bailing them out with taxpayers' money. Scrap the ineffective emissions trading scheme and replace it with a tax on carbon consumption. And to create a more decent and dynamic economy, shift the burden of tax off hard work and enterprise and onto land ownership and inheritance. To make this happen, our politics needs to change too. We live in an era of technocratic mismanagement rather than political leadership, of narrowly framed policy choices, short horizons, and limited ambitions. Hemmed in by vested interests and bereft of big ideas, most politicians try to muddle through rather than shaking things up. They nip and tuck, duck and dive, instead of painting a compelling picture of a brighter future and battling to achieve it. And then they blame voters for not being inspired. We need bold leaders, political entrepreneurs, and a grassroots movement for change. A more open politics, more open to new and different views, more open in how candidates are selected, more open about the funding of political parties, more open about lobbying. Parliaments that are more representative of popular opinion. Citizens' initiatives to address the issues that MPs neglect. New forms of deliberative democracy that engage citizens in informed decision-making. And yes, here I agree with Roger. Europeans need a greater say over the future direction of the EU and a possibility to change course. Europe desperately needs to change. Deal with the current crisis decisively and fairly. Create lasting shared prosperity by making our economies more adaptable and more decent and more dynamic. Reform the Eurozone. Create a more open, accountable and democratic European Union with genuine political choice. Update our politics trapped in a bygone industrial age with a more open politics fit for the internet age. And stand up for those locked out of the system, not in the hateful way that extremists like UKIP do, but by opening up opportunities for everyone to get ahead. Create a Europe truly united in diversity, where everyone could be different, equal, and belong. Stagnation, decline, and disillusionment are not inevitable. Europe needs hope, a politics of genuine optimism, a prospectus for a better tomorrow. We need to put the mistakes of the past behind us and embrace the future with all its possibilities for progress. We desperately need a European spring, economic and political renewal. Thank you.
Well, Philip, do you think you've made yourself clear enough? I think that was, I think we'll agree on another spirited presentation. Both our speakers, I think, have done us proud. But that sounds as though I'm about to say goodbye to them. We've got half an hour still. Thank you both for a most stimulating set of remarks. And I'm going to throw this open to the floor. As I say, we've got about half an hour. Please indicate if you would like to speak. Say what your name is. Say what your affiliation is. Usual procedure. Keep it short and sweet. No speeches, please. I think that what I will do is invite questions one by one and give both our speakers the opportunity to respond. But as I say, short and sweet, please. John Palmer at the front, and then with the lady at the back.
Thank you very much for an interesting debate, John Palmer. I just want to make one remark apropos of Roger's presentation, just in passing. He said that there was no anticipation in the foundation of what became the European Union of eventually embracing the wider Europe. Actually, that's not the case. If you read the memoirs of Jean Monnet and Max Kornstam, that was a preoccupation. At first, they thought it would happen much later than they first imagined, and then it happened much quicker than they subsequently thought it would happen, but it was always factored in from the beginning. My question is really directed to Philippe, with whose remarks I almost completely ratify and endorse and fully agree with. I was very interested in his book that he points out, he draws attention to, and he's spoken about, the need to write down debt. And I'd like to ask him both on that and on a more symmetrical fiscal policy in Europe, Germany and the rest, how he sees the optimum political route in the short to medium term to actually achieve both those objectives, and where does he think the remarkable insights of Thomas Piketty fit in the picture of the changes that Europe needs might fit with the rest of what he has been telling us?
Okay, I'm sure you'll both want an opportunity to like that, not Roger. Philip, go ahead, please, and then the lady at the back.
Yeah. I think the best way to write down debts is through a debtors' conference. I mean, at the end of the day, because of Angela Merkel's mistakes, German taxpayers are going to take losses on their loans to Greece, so it would be better to make a virtue of it and to make it a gesture of European solidarity, launch a Marshall Plan for investment. Jean-Claude Trichet could atone for his sins. Actually, he did the Paris Club negotiations that granted Poland debt relief in 1991, and he could perhaps chair the conference and thus repair his reputation. In terms of achieving a more symmetrical fiscal policy, I mean, the problem is that due to both the EU fiscal rules and the fiscal compact, we are kind of locked into what most people haven't realized is basically everlasting austerity. short of treaty change or revoking the fiscal compact treaty, is going to be very difficult to break out of that. So that.
Okay, good, thank you. Yes, the lady at the back near the door.
I'm Ava, I work in finance. My question is for Mr. Bootle. Thank you for your comments. I was quite interested in your statement that you think it would be in the UK's favour to exit the single market and go on to negotiate a free trade agreement with the EU. But I think given how challenging the negotiations have been with the US and the European Union, and let alone any of the other states that you mentioned that might be negotiating, in terms of the time frame, do you think then the UK would be fast-tracked ahead of these conversations? I mean, what do you think is the actual possibility of that actually, of other European states accepting that outcome or willing to work within a reasonable time frame to achieve that?
Oh, I think the probability or likelihood is extremely high, because for a start we'd be much less awkward than the Americans, who are partly at fault in these negotiations, I would say. A very important point to bear in mind is that the UK is the rest of the EU's single largest export market, bigger even than the United States. The notion that the EU or the rest of the EU is going to say, you know, well, to hell with Britain, is frankly bizarre. What's more, the rest of the EU runs a significant trade surplus with the UK. So in the event of a UK withdrawal, I think you'll see all sorts of continental companies, not least the German car manufacturers, jumping up and down, being keen to get some sort of agreement with the UK. Now, I'm not going to say it's easy. It wouldn't be easy. I think it'd be pretty tricky, and there would be a drawn-out process, and there would be risks involved in it. And that's one of the reasons why I said to you earlier on, my first best position in all this would be for Britain to stay in the EU, but to negotiate hard and get a deal at least that was a very different EU for us, even if it didn't transform the rest of the EU. That would be the first best for the solution. But if we came out, yeah, I'm pretty clear in my mind that we would be able to negotiate a pretty favourable agreement with the EU, even though it would be bumpy and even though it would take time.
Philip, do you want to say anything?
Well, I mean, this figure about, you know, they export more to us than we to them, actually, as a share of GDP, we export 14%. Of our GDP to Europe, and the rest of Europe sends 2.5% of their GDP to us. So who matters more to whom? That's my question. Second of all, there are already, even within the single market, many countries, not least in France, who resent the fact that what they see is Britain gaining an unfair competitive advantage through devaluation. Now, imagine within the single market, the ability of protectionists in France to respond is rather limited. Imagine if you have to negotiate an agreement, and imagine after that whether if you are able to impose anti-dumping duties, as the EU has done even on Norway, which has the closest relationship, short of being in the EU. So I think that the politics of this are actually much more difficult than Roger allows for.
Thank you. More questions? Yes. The gentleman there.
Could the sound be louder, please?
Sound be louder.
Well, I'm too far away.
A little bit closer. Yes, anyway, sorry, the gentleman over there in the blue shirt. Yeah. Point taken, and we'll bring mics a bit closer. Anyway, yeah. Please.
Yes, my name's Richard O'Brien. I'm a sort of ex-economist, ex-banker, so it's none of my fault. I mean, it seems to me both ex-economists. Ex-economists, yes. Are you allowed to be an ex-economist now? seems to me both our speakers are probably agree with each other greatly, because if you take Roger's opening historical picture, what we need to look at, where are we now? And I think both would say Europe is now finding it really, really hard to compete with the rest of the world. We've really got to get our act together. And that's not about deciding whether we have a European Union or not, or unravel all that. I mean, that really is sort of messing around with driven by populist politics, messing around with institutional things and fighting amongst ourselves, whereas in fact there's a lot of things we just don't do very well and competitively now. I mean, look at Japan was exactly the same. They didn't have to get rid of their banks when they went bust. They just didn't face up to realities. And it seems to me, if we don't face up to the realities of we're frankly going down the tubes globally, comparatively speaking, and we won't compete by being closed and not open, we've just got to face up, we've got to adapt.
Yep.
And the trouble is, most big things, climate change, obesity challenges, all these things, we're so hopeless at adaptation. And we need a sort of politics of adaptation, not a politics of saying it'd be better if we changed the institutional structure. Because I'm not convinced we'd... I mean, look, Britain, within being in or outside, hasn't done its, reformed its banking system any better than they would have done with the EU or without it.
I'm sure Philip will have things to say about that as well. But let me, if I may, quickly respond to that. The first thing I want to say is there's no doubt in my mind that lots of things that are wrong in Europe of the sort that you've talked about, and indeed Philip has talked about, are nothing whatever directly to do with the EU. There's a certain sort of Eurosceptic who thinks that the EU, you know, is responsible for everything that's gone wrong in our economies, and it's complete and utter hogwash. There are all sorts of things, nothing whatever to do with the EU, at least not directly, which have gone wrong, which we need to deal with. There is, however, though, I think a side relevance of the EU in this regard in two senses. First of all, we've had the absorption of the European political elites and the spending of European capital and the absorption of the intellectual elites on a project which, in my view, at best has been useless and at worst actually harmful. That's to say, further European integration and more recently the euro. An obsession about this where and getting harmonisation and commonality and all that stuff, whereas actually what these people ought to have been doing is concentrating on the economic fundamentals. And if you look at the Lisbon Agenda, all sorts of fine stuff in that, actually, for what Europe should be doing. Have we done much about it? No. That's the first point I'd say about the sense in which, in a side way, the European Union is relevant. That's to say, the misdirection of effort. The second sense in which I think it's relevant is the point I made about national competition. I'm not saying this solves it, because there's a whole lot of other things need to be sorted out, but there's a sense in which I think if the European Union were not there, and the European nation, or something else was there, but much less intrusive, directed towards ever closer union, I think you'd find the individual nation states of Europe competing with regard to many of the things that you mention need to be put right. Now, as it is, they don't see themselves as competing. They see themselves going down a similar path. The third thing I think I want to say is that I'm puzzled by all those things that have got nothing whatever to do with the European Union, but which contribute to European relative decline. I wish I had the answer to them, but I don't. Let me give you one aspect which is particularly apposite in this great institution: intellectual and academic decline. Why are there so few European universities in the world's top league, and why does it look as though there are going to be fewer and fewer over the next 10 to 20 years? I mean, what has gone wrong with European academia? I don't know the answer to it, but it seems to me to be a part of what you're describing. I mean, there's some areas where it's quite relatively easy to put the problem right, it seems to me. The labour market, for instance. There's so many, in some European countries, appalling measures that are quite definitely against the interests of workers in general. But there are a whole set of other things that are difficult. This point about dynamism, entrepreneurialism. Okay, you can change the tax treatment of saving, the tax treatment of investment. You can give all sorts of help to new companies and so on and so forth. Do you really think, can one be convinced that that's actually going to spur European dynamism? I'm not, personally. So I'm afraid I've got two things I'm definitely sure of and two other things I've just got questioned.
Well, I agree with you, Richard, that Europe needs to adapt and that its adaptation doesn't depend to a large extent on EU institutions and, in particular, whether Britain is part of Europe or not. I partly agree with Richard, Roger. There is a misdirection of energy. I mean, I think having worked in Brussels for 3 years, admittedly, in the midst of a crisis, it is a pretty inward-looking place, and there is an obsession with, you know, who's up and who's down and how the institutions interact with each other, almost to the neglect of everything else. But that doesn't mean that you have to have misdirection of energies at a national level. And since many of the things we're talking about are about national governments doing it, that doesn't necessarily follow. I disagree with Roger's point about national competition. There is plenty of national competition within the Eurozone, indeed within the European Union. Just look at how the French and others object to there being such low tax rates in Ireland, or how France and Germany and Britain all compete for the same contracts in Asia. So there's plenty of national competition. Unfortunately, Britain's not very good at it. We actually export less to China as our share of GDP than any other EU 15 country, including Greece. So, yes, we need to adapt, yes, it's not much to do with the EU.
Yes, gentlemen, yes.
I'm surprised that we haven't discussed the... Oh, sorry, Simon Osborne. I run a research and media company in the city, and I was here about 20 or 30 years ago. Anyway,
I'm... We're in class together. You probably don't recognise me.
Oh, hello. Nice to see you again. anyway, I'm surprised that we haven't discussed the euro crisis more than we have done so far this evening. There's been a lot of generalities throughout this debate. For me, that was a quantum leap forward in terms of the disaster that's unfolding in Europe, and I don't see anyone, including Philippe this evening or many other people, really addressing what is going to happen as a result of the euro crisis. Can I just put forward one idea that Norman Lamont discussed back in the beginning of the 1990s, which was the idea, this is when it was all about to be implemented, having the euro as an additional currency, more of an Anglo-Saxon evolutionary approach to the introduction of the euro. Obviously, that didn't happen. But is there a possibility as an exit strategy for Europe from the euro? Perhaps that could be tried again. In other words, countries within the eurozone, particularly the southern European countries, the Italys, the Spains, the Greeces, having their own domestic currency, but also retaining the euro for pan-European transactions. Because someone's going to have to come up with some kind of a radical solution. I don't see anybody really addressing this at all. People are talking in broad generalities, but not really addressing the point.
Well, I'm not going to rehearse my long speech, but I'd addressed around half of it to the euro in probably two great specifics for most of the people in this audience. My answer is that breaking up the euro is not the solution to a banking and debt crisis. We've had mass devaluation here in Britain, and exports have remained flat. So the idea that devaluation is a solution to a banking and debt crisis, I think is far-fetched. What we haven't done is we haven't grappled with the banking crisis, and we haven't written down debts. And until we do that, we're not going to get out of this mess.
Now, on this question of the euro being an alternative currency, I'd have to think that through, but I don't think it actually solves any of the critical issues. I mean, it enables a country that otherwise might leave or be ejected, as it were, to stay in some sense, and maybe it diminishes some of the losses that might emerge from higher transactions costs and so on from those companies in that zone and that country who want to carry on using the euro. But these are minor things, really. I mean, the big issues are all to do with the denomination of the debt in euros versus the need for these countries to become competitive relative to others within the eurozone. And I think you'll find, if you trace this apparent solution through, you'll find it doesn't deal with either of those issues. There's an almighty debt hanging over from the past in relation to current productive means. It's as simple as that. How are you going to deal with it? You know, you can try and cut back your spending and increase taxes and so on and so forth, if you like. Here I very much agree with Philip. I think this is a largely self-defeating exercise from the point of view of Europe as a whole. You can try to get some sort of debt forgiveness, or you can default, or you can try and grow your way out of all this. I think the southern countries of Europe are coming to the point where there's going to be no way out apart from default or someone actually writing the debt off for them. I don't believe they can grow their way out of it. I certainly don't believe they can get out of it by more austerity. Now, with regard to your more general point, I agree with you when you say that the advent of the euro represented an intensification of the problems. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in the book, my book, I say that the euro is the clearest example of the defectiveness of European decision-making processes, and it stems straight from the Treaty of Rome. If you want to set up ever closer union, this is, I think, a route that's pretty clear to move towards that objective. In economic terms, it was surely completely unnecessary. I think it was. And premature, actually, even if you want to move towards ever closer union. It was an unnecessary integration, and it brought all sorts of ghastly consequences for the European project. I don't think it's going to be possible to get out of these consequences myself. I think we're going to see some major, major shift. That's to say, a country or two undergoing significant default and possibly being forced out of the euro.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to try and squeeze in two more questions. Before I invite questioners, just to draw your attention to the fact that there is a reception, there's a drinks party, immediately after this event, starting at 8, to which everybody is very warmly invited. It is just outside. When you leave the theatre, you take a left, you'll be directed by students towards the atrium. And as I say, everybody is very, very welcome to come and have a glass of wine or whatever after this event. So, yes, last two questions. Is there anybody outside my direct line?
You've got two over there.
Sorry?
You've got two there.
Yes.
And there's one or two over there, actually.
Well, indeed. And now I can already see the invidious choice falls to me, and I'm afraid that the inevitably capricious and arbitrary element to it. The gentleman in the lilac, in the mauve shirt on the edge, and then I will swing back to the other side of the...
Hi, my name is George Grigoropoulos. I'm from the Liberty Forum of Greece. I would like to ask first Roger why he opposes the freedom of movement from Turkey as an example. Don't you think that that's an essential element of competitiveness against between nations? Because I guess people vote with their feet just like that, and they choose the best policies. The other question I would have is what makes him think that a non-EU member UK wouldn't move towards more regulation instead of less. And for Philippe, a couple of questions, please. I'll try to squeeze them really quickly. you mentioned austerity, but I would like to know, what do you think? Has it been more on the tax increases or on the side of spending cuts?
Okay, thank you. Stop with that.
Okay.
Sorry, as I said, we will call one more person. Please, would you like to, either of you, like to...
Yes. On the point about Turkey, I think what I said, certainly what I meant to say, was not so much that I was against it as that the peoples of Europe wouldn't wear it. It simply was a non-starter. And as much as anything, this stems, I think, from the big gap in GDP, as well as certain cultural differences between Turkey and the rest of the EU. And if you look at the GDP per capita of the countries that originally joined the EEC in 1957, you find that there were very small differences indeed. And then when the Union, as we now call it, expanded later in 1973, again, there weren't the differences were quite small, actually, between the new members and the old members. And then the expansion of 2004 brought in some countries which were wildly divergent in terms of GDP per capita and general development, and Turkey is a stage further. And the result of all that, I think, is that you would find European electorates implacably opposed to it. On your second question, what makes me think that a UK outside the EU would not impose more regulation? It's certainly possible, and going back in the political development of this issue, it's quite striking, of course, that the Labour Party was traditionally the anti-EU party, and the reason why it was anti-EU was it saw the EU as a capitalist club, and there were lots of senior Labour Party characters who thought, well, outside the EU, we can run things in the way we want, but inside we can't. So it is possible to imagine that. I think it's unlikely. I have to say, I think it's unlikely. If we came out, then I think we would be doing so in a spirit of, gosh, we're now paddling our own canoe. I think probably the deregulation gambit would be stronger, but I agree with you. It's not by any means certain. Yeah.
Philip, did you want to say anything to that? And I'm going to
I'm glad that Roger has conceded that point, because I always think there's kind of a fantasy politics in this country, certainly by many Eurosceptics who imagine that if only Britain was set free from the EU, it would be reshaped into whatever a particular stripe they fancy. So on the hard left, it would become a hard life paradise. On the far right, it would become a far right paradise. And the reality is that the politics of Britain and the constraints that imposes would be rather similar.
Thank you. Sorry, there was a gentleman. Yeah, a gentleman over here. Just here. Sorry.
Oh,
this gentleman.
Yes, sir. Oh, thank you. Right, that's very kind. I wasn't in your class either, so thank you. Mike Howell. We could, in many ways, have had these arguments 20 years ago, to be fair. Pardon me?
What do you do?
Oh, sorry, what do?
I ask people just to say whether...
Oh, right, okay. I've got an economic research company in London. We could have had this debate about 20 years ago, to be honest, in many ways. But what has changed? Time has moved on, and the power of any state is dependent on the tax base. And as Roger noted, the demographic situation in Europe is pretty dire. Populations are declining, and they're certainly aging. Now, how does that affect the vision thing about Europe? It clearly must affect things.
Well, I'll say something. Yes, I think it does. In my book, I talk about it. I mean, it's one of those factors which makes for the likelihood of comparative European decline over the decades ahead. And productivity growth, as Philippe said, has been low. Of course, we could take measures to bring it higher. But also, as well as that, there's the fact that the demographic outlook is extremely poor. Again, of course, there are ways to address that directly, but they would involve presumably substantial amounts of immigration, which the European electorates are unlikely to accept.
Good. Okay. Well, I hope we can all agree that we've had a really stimulating and rich and textured hour and a half. Our speakers have done us proud. I wish we had time to continue our conversation. There will be an opportunity to do so. It's not too rankly antisocial to do so over drinks at the receptions. I say everyone is very warmly invited. But I think it's a moment really to show our appreciation to our speakers and just to remind you that the books are on sale, their respective books are on sale outside this hall, and they're happy to sign copies of the books. They're sitting on the podium for another few minutes yet, after which they'll come to the reception and we'll have the opportunity to meet them in person. So thank you, Philippe. Thank you, Roger, for what's been a very, very stimulating 90-odd minutes. Thank you.